Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Juror 13 Show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next hour, I'll be your host. And tonight, we have quite an agenda, actually, and quite a panel. First, I'd like to introduce our guest, journalist and author Lisa Sweetingham. Lisa was formerly with Court TV, and she is now working as a correspondent for In Session. And we'll get to that part of her life in just a minute. But I'd like to start out talking about her new novel. It's a book titled Chemical Cowboys. Lisa, welcome to the Juror 13 Show. And could you give us a little rundown, the listeners, about what your Chemical Cowboys is about?
Hi, Denny. It's so great to talk to you again. Chemical Cowboys actually is the result of 4 years of my own personal research around the world, talking to detectives, drug cops, agents, drug dealers, judges, et cetera, et cetera. And it follows a period of time when the Israeli mafia controlled the ecstasy trade. And it essentially follows the story of this maverick DEA agent named Bob Gagne, who is still undercover in New York. And in fact, in the book, photos of Agent Gagne, his eyes are blacked out because we had to protect his identity. And it follows his story about how he really was the first agent to kind of go after ecstasy, to go undercover as a gay raver in the nightclubs of New York to figure out who were the buyers, who were the dealers. And ultimately, he uncovered this amazing network, this international network that was making billions of dollars in the ecstasy trade, and that was ultimately linked back to organized crime and mafia in Tel Aviv.
And 4 years in the writing, or the research and writing.
Yeah, a long 4 years. But I have to say, I enjoyed every minute of it. And we've talked about this book a little bit before. There's nothing like being able to, I received full access from the DEA and also from Israeli National Police. And so a lot of it was me sitting in the back room at DEA reading through case after case after case and listening to undercover taped recordings and looking at photos. And I love that stuff. So it was really a joy to report and write this book.
Well, congratulations on the book, and is there any special place that people can get a copy, any website or a special store or anything?
Yeah, sure. It's in just about anywhere books are sold in major bookstores, and you can also go online to my website, which is lisasweetingham.com, and on my website there's like a Q&A with me, and there's more information about the book, and there's a couple sample chapters, and then, you know, there's just a few links to buy it online if you like. And also, I should add, the Australian version just came out this week, and it's got a really cool, you know, funky Australian cover on it. So I'm excited about
okay.
that.
Well, again, congratulations on the book. Now,
let's move
on to your current job as a correspondent for In Session. And it happened, I saw you today on True TV because you are covering the Trimble, the Marsha Trimble murder trial, of what, 33 or 34-year-old cold case out of Tennessee.
Yeah, this is an amazing trial. We're doing gavel-to-gavel coverage on True TV, which is formerly Court TV. And it's essentially Nashville's most famous unsolved mystery. And a lot of folks out here refer to it as the JonBenet case of Nashville. About 34 years ago, a little girl named Marsha Trimble, she was 9 years old, and she was a Girl Scout, and she was at home in her very predominantly white upper-middle-class neighborhood, and she told her mom, oh, the neighbor's home, I'm going to run over there and get money for cookies and deliver her cookies. It was about 5:30 in the evening, and Marsha Trimble ran out of the house, and was never seen again until 33 days later when her body was found in a garage that was being used as storage. The interesting thing about this case is that it's just been so long, and it haunted the community, and there was so much press about it, and year after year, reporters would come back to it and say, whatever happened to this girl? And it really was sort of the end of the innocence for Nashville and for this community. And for a long, long time, the profilers, they even had FBI that did profiles of the potential perpetrator. And for a long time, they thought that it was a local boy who was probably a teenager, a loner, someone that she knew. I should say that she was found, they think she was sexually assaulted, and she was strangled to death. So the neighborhood was looking for one of their own. They were looking for a white male teenager. They never found anyone. And then, about a year ago, investigators had reopened the case, done some DNA work, and now they believe that the perpetrator is a man named Jerome Barrett, who is 62 years old. He's a convicted felon who's had three sexual assaults to his name, including one murder rape that he was just convicted of this year, back from 1975. And he's a black man. And, you know, the race typically, you know, whether it is or isn't an issue in a trial, in this trial, it's a big issue because the one thing that his defense keeps saying is, how can this man, who would have been 27 at the time of the murder, have walked into this neighborhood where everyone knew each other, found this girl, kidnapped her, taken her into a local garage, and no one saw him? So it's a fascinating trial. I'm really so engaged in it, and it's so interesting. And, you know, if anyone happens to be watching True TV during the day, I would say check it out.
Well, I did today, and I was captivated. And
me too.
I was going to ask you about the issue you just mentioned about that community in the 1970s and how a 27-year-old black man could have apparently unseen by anyone except Marsha gotten in, did the deed, and gotten out, you know, without being noticed. And as you mentioned, that's going to be a big issue by the defense. Do you think the prosecution has to respond to that some way, or can they just kind of try to ignore it?
Well, they've been trying to do that. We had a couple of witnesses today who... This is the thing. I see this all the time, and you see this with eyewitness testimony. It's like the testimony is only as good as what the witness wants to believe at the time. And it's such an old case. But, for instance, we had a woman on today who was the neighbor of the Trimbles, and she may have been the last person to see Marsha alive who doesn't know what happened. And she believed that she saw her with two boys, two white children. Today, on the stand, she's kind of hemming and hawing about her testimony, and now she's saying, you know, I don't really know if they were white. I'm not sure what the race was. And it's such a huge issue because it's really true. I mean, in this community at that time, everyone kind of knew each other, and all the kids, they would go door to door selling magazine subscriptions and Girl Scout cookies, and, you know, everyone left their door unlocked, and there really weren't a lot, if any, black families in that neighborhood. And someone would have said something. Someone would have seen it. And, in fact, her body was found in a garage that was 200 yards from her own home. I should add, it was a garage that had no doors, like no door handles. It was just that one main garage door. So whoever opened it had to have, like, made that sound and opened the door and brought her in and then closed the door. There weren't any cars in the garage. It was just being used for storage. It just seemed so unlikely that no one would have noticed this 27-year-old black man in this neighborhood at that time.
Well, this promises to be very interesting. What do you estimate the trial will go for, about how many days?
Well, you know, they do things kind of fast here. So, okay. I mean, in California, with like Phil Spector and Robert Blake, and my, you know, jurors in California have it easy. We don't go on Fridays. We finish up around 3:34. Out here in the South, they sequester the jury, at least in Tennessee, because it's so high profile. And because these jurors are being taken away from their families and they're living in a hotel, they're not allowed to talk to anyone. It's likely we're going to work weekends, and we'll probably work late nights. So I think that we may actually either see a verdict by Monday or at least have this to the jury by the weekend.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah, pretty fast, I think.
I guess. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I suppose I am. is there any chance that after the verdict comes down, that we could get you back on sometime to kind of
I'd love to. And that means that everybody has to watch.
Absolutely. Well, I know quite a few of the people who are listening tonight are into the trial already. I didn't tune in until later, but I guess the mom's testimony really was got the attention of a lot of people. I guess she was quite a witness. What did you think?
Yeah, Virginia Tribble.
She brought tears to the eyes of some.
She did. She, you know, it's been 34 years, and she's a very religious woman. She was a teacher, a kindergarten teacher, at the time her child was taken from her. And she talked a lot about praying, how she's been praying since the day she disappeared. And, you know, and I recently read that she, when they came to her to say, you know, we got the guy, whether they did or not, her feeling was she prayed for Jerome Barrett, the defendant, and she really wants to know if he did it, why did he do it, and how did he do it? There's so many unanswered questions that this mother has. And I should say also the father, Charles Trimble, he passed away, it was several years ago, but this death in the family really split them up. They just didn't make it through this. And after they divorced, Charles Trimble died 3 days later.
Aye.
Yeah.
I talk about when it rains, it pours, huh? It's,
Yeah. A lot of sadness in this family. I mean, the one good note is that Virginia Trimble did fall in love again, and she remarried, and she lives in Kansas now with her husband. But, you know, I think he's also suffering from some health problems. So she's in court every day. There's a lot of family in court, not just for the Trimble family, but also for Jerome Barrett. Today I spoke to his sister. He has a sister, his mother's in court. He has a daughter. I wasn't aware that he had a daughter, but she's in court. They're all very nice-looking family, and they're there to support him, too.
Well, what I'm going to do is, after the verdict, I'll send you an email or something, and maybe, you know, in a relatively short time, the thing is fresh in everyone's mind, we can get together and you can help us along and help us maybe understand and analyze how the jury comes to whatever decision they reach.
Yeah, let's do it. That would be great.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lisa, and we'll do that. Now, we have our main topic of the evening is going to be the what we're calling the Ted Binion trials. And I happen to live in Vegas, but even if I didn't live there now, I play poker on occasion. I would know the Binion name from that. So anybody who lives in Vegas, has been to Vegas, or is a poker player would probably know, have heard of Binion's Horseshoe Casino in downtown Las Vegas. What the Ted Binion is the son of Benny Binion, was the son of Benny Binion, the founder of the casino. And Ted was found dead in his home on September 17th of 1998, and apparent drug overdose. After investigation, the police determined that it may not have been an accidental overdose, and they subsequently arrested in 1999 Ted's live-in girlfriend, Sandy Murphy, and a fellow who had become a friend of Ted's and apparently a friend or a little more to Sandra Murphy, named Rick Tabish. And they were charged with his murder and some other crimes regarding theft of some silver and burglary and that type of thing. And they were convicted in their first trial in 2000 of several crimes, including the murder of Ted Binion. However, the Nevada Supreme Court overturned the convictions in, I believe, 2003, and they had a retrial. And in the retrial, in November of 2004, they were found not guilty of the murder charges. Some of the other charges remained, but the chief charge, the murder verdicts, were not guilty. So we're going to talk about that tonight, and joining Lisa on the panel are two of Juror 13's Binion trial experts, Love Law and Kendi. Love and Kendi,
hello.
Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Glad you can be with us. And I think let's start out, Love, with you, and could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved or became tuned in to the Binion trials?
Kendi, you want to go first?
Okay, Love. Well, I brought my books out today, and I was trying to remember. I can't even remember why the verdicts got overturned. Was it something to do with the juror being on the internet and all that?
Something, according to the paperwork
actually,
I've got.
I think it was because they didn't sever. They should have severed the silver heist, I believe.
Is
yeah,
that
they
what
didn't sever the charges.
Oh my gosh!
I think from what I recall, they it was prejudicial to Sandy
right.
that they brought in evidence about Rick Tavish's having kidnapped and held a business partner and other things.
The guy he beat with the phone book.
Right.
Yep,
the
that was
book
it.
The phone book down at the mine.
That was it.
Oh, wow. And that
yeah.
was like my favorite part of the trial. The whole story about him beating him with a phone book and making him dig his own grave out there in the mines
yeah.
and all
yes.
that.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
In my opinion, I think they were both totally guilty, and it got overturned to me on a technicality. So
yeah,
that's really my opinion.
I think we're both on the same page on that one. One of the things that stuck out to me, it still sticks out to me, is the fact that the items around his body, I know there were lighters, cigarettes, and all of the prescription drug bottles, none of them had any prints on them. You know, so, I mean, if he, in my opinion, if he overdosed and, you know, laid there with all that stuff around him, you would think that his fingerprints would be on something. So they were must have been wiped clean by somebody.
Totally staged.
So that's what
I mean, you know. Staging
yeah.
101, they should have paid a little bit more of attention to court TV at the time because,
right.
really, that was just ridiculous.
Think?
And they also posed him in the mortuary position and put him on the floor there where he never would have been in a million years.
Right.
And in the video the next day, Sandy just stepped right over where his dead body was.
Exactly. And there was a vomit trail, too, as I recall.
That's right.
There's no way that if he was sick, to me, that he'd have then come back, laid down, and then just died.
No, nope,
it
didn't happen.
I don't think so either.
I gotta say, if any of us were gonna be planning a murder, we'd all really know exactly what to do, wouldn't we?
What did you think
and what not to do.
You saw both. What did you think?
I gotta say, I was surprised with the verdict. Because it did seem to me like there was just so much evidence showing that these two were up to no good. I mean, you know, and like you said, the no prints on the empty bottle of Xanax, the Bic lighters, the pack of cigarettes, it was very strange. But I think because he was a heroin addict and because he did have this propensity to self-destruction,
right? It was.
I think they're just, you know, I think the jury just decided that, oh, here was another thing. One of my favorite witnesses in this trial was Dr. Michael Bodden. And
oh,
the jurors
yeah.
did not believe him at all. And you had to kind of believe him to believe how they would have killed Ted Binion.
Right, the Birking theory.
I
think they probably tried to overdose him, and he just wasn't dying because he had tolerance. Even though he smoked it, they had forced it down his throat, right? So it was in his stomach.
Right.
And he wasn't dying
well,
that
was
that.
The theory, sure. Yeah, that was the prosecution theory.
But he had never eaten it, ever. That was not how he took it.
No.
So to me, that was just – but really, what convinced me totally that they were guilty was that they were on the cell phone together 24/7.
Exactly.
Except for that little six-hour period or whatever that
was.
No cell phone calls going back and forth.
And the one thing that I focused on a lot, and being right there in the courtroom, I could really see it, the red mark on his chest that Bodden attributed to being a button mark from the Birking.
Mm-hmm.
It really, to me, it really did look like a button mark. But I also thought that if he was chasing the dragon with the heroin, that it could have also been a burn mark. So I think you could have. That was the only thing, though, that stuck out to me that I didn't. I kind of thought it looked like a button mark, and I still do to this day. But so.
Well, you know, remember they were in a time crunch too, because they had the Tom. What's his name? The gardener was driving his mower around looking in the windows.
Right.
So they were in a time crunch there, and he was just not dying fast enough.
So I think the button mark was big to me, because when I saw it up close, it really looked like a button mark, because you could almost see the little holes, you know, where the threads would go through.
Yep.
It was just so perfectly. That's
what I
thought anyway. So.
Ladies, can I interrupt just a second? I was monitoring the chat room here, and a couple of questions. One is a suggestion that someone, if one of you knows, what was Dr. Bodden's theory exactly of how this came down? Did he have a specific theory that he presented on the stand as to what happened?
Yes, it's called Birking. He thought how they used to kill in the old days in the 1800s in England, that somebody named Edmund Burke or something like that would hire guys to go out and kill winos. And
actually, it's a really famous case, and it's a great case. And this is something that I, since that trial, on occasion, like if my boyfriend's, you know, like too heavy or something, I'll tell him, you're birking me, because after and he'll be like, well, what are you talking about? But there were these. This is a really famous case. There were these two men, William Burke and William Hare. And essentially, they were making money by selling corpses of their victims, and they're selling them for a dissection. They were in the UK, and they had one doctor in particular who would buy all of these bodies from them. And the way that they did it was, one of them, I don't remember if it was Burke or Hare, but one of them was severely obese. And so while one would smother the victim's mouth, the other would sit on the victim's chest. And it was kind of shocking to me, because if someone lays on your chest and they're heavy enough, you can't breathe. You can't move your lungs to gather in air. And it was a really good way that they were able to kill people with like a minimal amount of bruising or any kind of sign that they had been suffocated to death. So Bodden came out with this theory that somehow Tabish and Murphy knew about Birking, and this is how they killed Ted Binion. And I have to say, I love the theory. It was a great, he was a great witness, but I don't know that anyone believed that Sandy and Rick were actually smart enough to know about this or to look it up or had any idea what
Birking meant. I think they just got lucky. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out if somebody's almost dead, that if you sit on them and hold something over their mouth, right? And didn't they think he had had something held over his mouth, too?
Right, yeah. And
you don't have to be a rocket scientist.
There wasn't any sign of him having been suffocated. There wasn't anything like, you know, the only thing that really supported that theory were the little red marks that they did look like buttons. It was such a great little
and
piece.
And he had petechiae,
didn't he?
I remember seeing an autopsy photo of him with the petechiae.
He did have that. And he did have redness around his mouth and lips.
That's right, love, he
did. And
they
thought that would have been from the hand over his mouth.
That's right.
While others, though, on the defense said that it was some sort of skin condition.
But, Lola, I don't want to put you on the spot, but would you tell them what happened when you were there with Bodden and with the jury? I had seen Sandy giving some juror the eye.
Oh, there was one juror giving her the eye and her giving it back. It was a younger man in the front row, and consistently they had Google eyes for each other. And I also remember, too, in the clippings that you sent me, and I can't find it now, but I do remember a quote from one of the jurors who said, Sandy did not look to me like she could have been involved in anything like this. And I always think, whenever I think of that, that I bet it was that juror. But yeah.
I always thought it was, too.
Yeah, so
I could tell just on her end of the googly eyes what was going on.
Yeah, yeah. And I met Bodden, and he was a very nice man, but I don't think he was revered as much in the second trial. The first trial, it seemed like they took him more as a celebrity, and because of that, I think they were just drawn to believing him, much like, you know, you would with Henry Lee or the others. But in the second trial, he didn't seem to affect even people that way, because I saw him waiting in the hall outside. And it didn't, you know, it seemed like I was the only one really that went up and talked to him. I don't know if he wasn't well known to a lot of people, but otherwise, he was a very nice man. And I did meet Sandy too, and that was an experience.
In the bathroom.
Bathroom. So, but that was fun. She asked me how I thought the trial was going, and I told her that I thought it was going really well for her, but that was only because I was alone with her in the bathroom.
I always said she was afraid Sandy was going to burk her in the bathroom.
So I just, oh, looks real good, Sandy, yep. I washed my hands and left.
Now, Lisa, you were covering this. Did you cover the first trial, too, or just the retrial for Court TV?
No, I only covered the retrial. I wasn't at Court TV yet.
Okay.
And the retrial was, the great thing about the retrial was, yeah, as you guys said, there were a lot of gallery there, a lot of people who were also like Sandy fans. There were a lot of women who were kind of enamored with her and who I think were, she was sort of an enigma to a lot of women in Vegas who were kind of looking for a sugar daddy, you know, kind of like, mm-hmm. It's hard work being a woman, and it'd be nice to meet a guy like Ted Binion who just wants to spend all his money on you. And she had a lot of fans in the courtroom, I think.
Celebrity
really
stripper.
Yeah. And,
another interesting thing was this man, William Fuller, who was her benefactor. I don't know if you guys remember him.
I do.
Oh, yes. I think she ended up with his house, didn't she?
I'm not sure.
I think she lived there, and I don't know what he recently died, I think a year ago, and I don't know if he left any money for her. But this was a guy who was, you know, multimillionaire, who really footed her defense, and he had an associate who came to court every day to see what was going on and report back to Bill Fuller.
Now, ladies, we have a caller, and I think I was remiss in giving out our number. If anybody does have a question or comment, you can reach us at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. Let's see who we have on the line.
Hello?
Caller from 702, you're on with us.
This is Dr. Jan from Las Vegas.
Hi, Doc.
Hey, calling because after the first trial, I took care of one of the jurors in my practice, and I won't mention her name, but she had died. But she was basically forced to give this guilty verdict. She didn't believe Sandy Murphy was guilty because of the fact that, this is from what she told me. Now, I'm only going by what she told me. The fact that the drug dealer delivered 12 black tar heroin that night or that day, and that he was taking Xanax from a doctor that he just filled, and he filled it for like 190 tablets or something of that nature.
That was his next-door neighbor, right?
Right. The doctor was his next-door neighbor. And so she was very distraught. I mean, she actually was sick because of the fact that she had to give this verdict that she did not want to, because the evidence wasn't really there for Sandy Murphy. And Rick Tavish's stupid thing was, he did build that Fort Trump for Ted Binion, but because he was stupid enough to go there that night after Binion died instead of waiting, because he was the only one that had the combination. If you saw this safe in Perum, it was built underground. I mean, nobody would have known it except the people who put it there.
I did go out and look at it.
Yeah.
This was just some years after that it happened, but it's in the weirdest place you can ever imagine.
Right. Well, I used to live out there in Pahrump, so, I mean, I'm telling you, it's out in no man's land where Jesus left his shoes. And I'm telling you, you would not have known it was out there unless you put it out there. And that's how that whole thing started with Rick Tavish, because the Nye County Sheriff happened to drive by. And
right.
That they were loading this and this
stupid
trailer.
Well, I don't think they happened to just drive by, did they? Or maybe they did. It was like 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning, and there were lights out that shouldn't have been out there.
Right. They were out there at that late at night, and it was all this equipment out there. And nobody, you know, people
why
got...
Why go at night if you were told to quit? You know,
he said he found a shit. He said he found a shitload of silver in the belly of the truck.
Yeah,
right.
It was, and it buckled. That's how they.
That was his
out.
Words, right?
Yep.
It buckled. The trailer buckled out there.
Right.
And it was. I mean, it was a lot of silver out there.
And I just don't believe. And I know there are a lot of people, I think, that really believe that Rick Tavish did it, and that Sandy Murphy maybe really wasn't involved.
Yeah, she
but
was not.
She had to know. I don't think you can be that close to someone and be having an affair with them.
Was there all that day. She was there.
Right. She was there, and the phone records.
And remember all
that
stuff about her? He had kicked her out, and she kept a key and took a chair and came around
the
back way and climbed back in. And they found her driver's license and stuff in the neighbor's backyard because she was running back and forth.
Right.
He had kicked her out.
Right. She was.
Right. He kicked her out, but. He has done that before to her.
Well, then why did she have to climb in the back window to get back in if he was letting her back in?
That's how she always used to get back in when he would kick her out.
Yeah, they had a very volatile relationship. I just want to remind everyone that while they were acquitted of the murder, they were convicted of the burglary charges. So the issue about the silver and the money that was missing in the safe at the home, the jury still did find them guilty of those.
Right.
Those
but
charges.
This particular juror that I dealt with, like I said, she was very. It made her so sick. The fact that they, you know, came up with this verdict, they basically bullied a lot of these women. They did not want to find Sandra Murphy guilty of this.
Really?
I'm wondering, caller, if she told you or you got a sense why she felt that she had to give a guilty verdict, or why she felt so bullied, or if there was ever a sense in her mind that she could talk to the judge about how she was feeling, or because
that's
fascinating to me with the jurors. What, you know, why she felt she had to go along with it.
Well, first of all, I mean, not to give out. Well, I guess I can because I'm not giving her name. She was not really all there in her mind. Number
mm-hmm.
one, this juror, and she was very paranoid anyway. And I don't think Judge Bonaventura, because of how he was on the bench, how he became, you know, volatile, if you will. You know what I'm saying? He was a mean person. She didn't feel she could talk to him. And nobody would believe her anyway.
Wow.
You know, that's what she kept saying. You know, nobody would believe her anyway. And then, you know, when they got the second trial, I think she felt kind of relieved, and then she kind of died like 3 weeks later.
Well, it would be sad to find somebody guilty who you didn't believe. Boy, I that would just go against every grain in my body. I don't care, you know, how
very,
the judge was.
Very sad she felt she couldn't tell anybody about
exactly,
it.
Exactly,
you know,
right.
Yeah.
But I think that Bonaventure did have that air about him that he was.
He could be a real jerk. I mean, I've seen him in action a few times.
But on the other hand, he could also be very funny during.
Because he was playing for the cameras in the show.
Yeah, exactly. He was.
He was trying to be like Judge Judy.
Right.
I had some friends at the time who thought they went not guilty, but they told me later that they really thought they probably did it, but they wanted them to get off in a Bonnie and Clyde type of way. That's the way they described it. So I think a lot of people maybe thought maybe they did it, but what the hey. Ted Binion maybe deserves it.
I think so, too.
Let me just interrupt with a question while we're mentioning the judge and that he may have been acting for the cameras to some degree. I know we heard a lot about this, too, in the O.J. Simpson trial, the original, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit trial, that perhaps Lance Ito was affected by the cameras. Now, Lisa, maybe this isn't a fair question to ask you because you work as a correspondent covering these trials, but do you think cameras, in spite of perhaps what the judge in the Binion trial did or Lance Ito did, generally speaking, are cameras in the courtroom a good idea?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they are. And I have to add that even though Bonaventure, it may have seemed like he was playing for the camera, he's that way whether a camera is in the room or not. I mean, he's just a very animated, funny, interesting, loud judge. He's constantly getting called out for his, you know, his antics in the courtroom. I don't think it makes a difference if the camera's there in his particular case. I think essentially what we find, and there have been a lot of studies about this with Court TV, is that once the cameras are in there, at first people worry if they're new to it. Maybe the judges might be a little concerned, but after the first day or even after a few minutes, you forget that they're there, and they're so unobtrusive. And the way they're designed now with the robocams, sometimes you don't even know that they're in the room. So I think in terms of that aspect, I think that goes away pretty quickly. Also, I think it's so important for the public to see these trials from beginning to end, because when you only get little snippets at the end of the day on Nancy Grace or Greta Fox or whatever you watch, you don't get the whole story. And you guys know, because you would watch the whole trials, it's so completely different when you're there and you hear all the testimony.
Yeah, really,
and at the end of the trial, you understand why the jury did what they did, or maybe you think there were mistakes that were made, but you can really judge it because you've seen all the evidence and not just openings and closings, which is not evidence, or not just little snippets with a commentator, you know, giving you their opinion of what's there, or Nancy Grace just making up facts about what happened. So I think that it's really, really important that we have cameras in the courtroom and cameras in the Supreme Court, bar none.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The reason why this trial got overturned was because Judge Bonaventure erred in the deliberations to the jury. That's how come they overturned it.
Yeah, there were a couple of things. He instructed them badly regarding some testimony, and so I think that they felt that he allowed in hearsay testimony that he shouldn't have allowed in.
I think one of the big things was also they felt that letting the statement in, if I die tonight, or take Sandy out of my will, if I die tonight, you know who did it.
Oh, right, right.
Basically, that could be construed as Binion testifying from the grave, and
right.
And
mm-hmm.
they aren't allowed
mm-hmm.
to do that. So, although we did see that in the Jensen case, where the Supreme Court did allow, you know, did let Mrs. Jensen's letter in that said that Mark was trying to kill her, if I recall from the Mark Jensen trial. So it's just interesting that they did allow that in, but in the Binion trial, it was partly overturned because of that statement going to the jury, if I recall right.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Let's just do a quick around the table here. Is the general consensus that they got away with murder or no?
Rick Kelly is still in prison, right? I think Rick is still in prison.
Yeah, he's got like two more years.
Oh, only two? Well, then the answer is yes. I think they got away with murder, yes.
I do too. I don't know that if Sandy was physically involved, but I totally believe that she was in on it in some way, as maybe not physically, you know, doing the sitting on him or whatever, but
right.
I believe she was involved.
There was a question in the chat room a little bit ago. I wasn't able to get to it right away, but I want to make sure I describe the relationship of Sandy Murphy and Rick Tabish with and Ted Binion appropriately. Sandy Murphy was his live-in girlfriend, correct?
Yeah,
correct.
Okay. Rick Tabish.
Well,
now,
maybe he might have kicked her out. There's evidence that she had been kicked out
right.
for good. There was a check that he had written to her that had been ripped up, so he was like writing her off and kicking her out.
But at least at one point, yes.
She had been. Okay, right. Now Rick, was he, according to the Review Journal article I looked at, to refresh my memory a little bit, it said that he had befriended Ted Binion. Was that, does anybody know, was that before he became involved with Sandra? Or was
yes,
he with
they
Sandra?
Met in the bathroom at a steakhouse, right? Uh-huh, but it was
right.
Probably a setup already.
Right.
Because they became fast friends, and right. Then Ted hired Rick and his trucks to build the to help him move the silver.
Oh,
he had been kicked out of the horseshoe, Ted had, and had to move his own personal stash of antique coins and silver dollars and all that. He, unfortunately, hired Rick Tabish and his trucks to help him move everything. I think they moved them to the house first and then built the pit out in Pahrump. But they met supposedly in a bathroom.
Yeah.
Oh. Boy, there's a lot of bathroom activity here in the people meeting.
Really, if you have a chance, read some of the books on it. It is really fascinating.
Yes, because
in any case.
Ted lost his gaming license because of him being on drugs.
Right.
And it wasn't the first time. It was many times. And then his sister Bonnie took over. After the last time,
right, and that was the big push in the first trial was everybody thought it was the Binion money machine that was,
or gangsters, you know, like Denny's specialty there because they had been Ted's house had been shot up and his nephews and everybody were supposedly involved in all kinds of bad stuff, but there were gangsters shooting at his house.
Yeah, so it really is. I mean, it has everything.
Not to bring the subject up, but Michael Jackson's house in Vegas was a block down the street from Binion.
You know, I thought I heard that address the other day, and I said, no way.
Wow.
Yeah.
You go into that neighborhood. I went by there. I had my husband drive me by there, and it's just not what you would think it is. It's not a fancy gated community or anything. You're kind of off the freeway, and there it is.
It used to be. It's off of Rancho there. And it's like in the back, and these homes were built way back in the day when these custom large lots were built.
Well, Ted's house is one of the least nice in the neighborhood, when you drive by there. It's not anything like you would think it would be. It's surrounded by billion-dollar mansions, you know.
Yeah, but it was just, I mean, I passed by it every day when I went to work because I had my office. Was around the corner there on Charleston, and I used to cut through Palomino there to get to my office. So I went by it every day. But, yeah, Michael Jackson's house was down that street, and it was backdated, too.
Interesting, too. I see.
You know, you mentioned Michael Jackson. I certainly hadn't intended to bring him into the show tonight, but I can't help but ask, with Michael, couple of points. First of all, and I guess there's an explanation for this, but still, I still find it somewhat humorous. My recollection is after his last molestation trial, he was rumored to be virtually bankrupt. So then I hear after he's dead that he's got a $500 million estate. So I don't know, maybe I'm just too low income, but that sounds like a lot of money.
Yeah,
the classified is being on the verge of bankruptcy.
You hear so many different things. He's $500 million in debt, and then he has a $500 million estate, and he's paying, you know, the family's paying millions of dollars to Debbie Rowe. So it kind of goes runs the gamut.
And how about, does anybody, Lisa, let me start with you, with your experience in this business. Do you foresee any thing happening, like maybe charges against the doctor or doctors involved for prescription violations or that type of thing? And I guess LaToya, I didn't hear this personally, but somebody told me that she has been making statements that this was actually a murder by Michael's entourage or something.
I would take anything LaToya says with a grain of salt, but but yeah, I mean, absolutely, I think they're going to be charges. And also, I think that we're going to probably see something in the Anna Nicole Smith case soon, too. That's not over. I know that DEA gets involved in these cases, not just because they're celebrity cases and so it brings more attention to their overall aims, but because they really do have a division that looks into diversion control and doctors who divert drugs illegally to patients. And so I'm sure they're getting involved in the investigation, and we're going to learn more about that soon. As they should. One of the things that bothers me so much about the Michael Jackson death is that, you know, he's been sainted and he loved his children and look at how beautiful his children are. And yes, clearly he loved his kids. But if you love your children, then you stay healthy and you deal with your drug addiction so it doesn't kill you, so you can stay around for them.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know, I tuned out some of the stuff again because I got Jacksoned out. I mean, there was such a deluge, it seemed like, no matter where you turned,
never ended.
A Michael Jackson
yeah.
story on. And I kind of, you know, I had my nose full of it, so I stopped listening after a while. Perhaps I missed some of the comments. And like I said, I didn't hear this LaToya allegation either. And probably just as well off that I didn't.
If I can just say this, and I understand, you know, not all doctors are bad, but, you know, some of these patients, and I'm talking about these drug seekers, you would be surprised how they can manipulate a doctor into giving them prescriptions. Now, granted, if we had a better system, now we have this system where is if Lovelock came in and said, hey, you know, doc, I want some Lortab, I can give her some Lortab, and then I can write to the DEA, we call it, and I would get this report 4 to 6 weeks later. That's after the fact that I found out that she's already been to 15 doctors.
Mm.
See,
how do you find that out?
Because this is how it works. If I wrote, because all narcotics, you know, Lortab and any of that have controlled substance numbers that are tracked by the pharmacy. So if I wrote you a script and you went to Walgreens, Walgreens logs that.
Okay.
And then when I write this letter to the DEA and I say I want the information on Lovelock and they send me back this report, it tells me all the pharmacies that you've been to because those are the ones that report it.
Okay.
And then I find out all the doctors.
Okay.
That's the
because
problem.
Because they did say that he would go to many different doctors.
Right, and the doctor wouldn't know from Adam. I mean, I would know if you never told me anything and I said to you, and you think that your patients are telling you the truth, and I said, you know, okay, Lovelock, have you been to any doctors for any other thing? Oh, no, this you are the only one. You know, my insurance doesn't take that, you know, this is the only place I would come.
Right.
And then you believe them, and even, you know, they won't even sign a record of their release because, you know, they claim they've never been to any other doctors.
Right. That's the problem with finding somebody guilty, finding a doctor guilty, because which doctor are they going to choose? Because I think
exactly.
There were so many.
Well, I think the best way to do this is if we can get the pharmacies, if I gave Lovelock a script and they went to go fill it and it pops up all these doctors, then the last doctor that she, you know, they just gave her that script, the pharmacy can call that doctor and say, hey, look, doctor, she's been to a few other doctors for this prescription. I can deny it then.
Right.
And not let it be filled. But other than that, it's out of my hands.
Yeah.
And there's nothing I can do about it. Now, granted.
You're saying, Doc, that the doctor, if a person is doctor shopping, if you will, looking for scripts, the individual doctors may not know if the patient lies and says, oh, no, you're the first doctor I've seen about this. But the pharmacy would be in a position to know because all that information, no matter what doctor or doctors had previously written scripts, would show up in a database somewhere, so they're in a better position to know than the physician seeing the patient.
Right, and then I had a case where I had written the script, and I'd written a script to Lovelock, and then I find out that she sold her bottle for for X amount of dollars to somebody else. And that's the other thing that they do. So, you know, drugs that are legitimately written for one person, that person then goes ahead and sells it to somebody else and makes money off of it. They sell it by tablet.
Yeah, I'm sure that's done a lot.
And that's where this whole thing comes. I mean, I know the drugs that were written for Michael were wrong. I mean, there's no reason for them to write the Diprovan or any of that. It's just no excuse for that, you know. But to give Demerol shots when Demerol can be done in a pill form, you know.
I think he got a lot of meds under other people's names, too. So that
but he would have his bodyguards go get it. Now, how do you track that? Do you know what
right.
I'm saying?
Right. There are so many ways. Like you said, if an addict wants something, they find ways to get it. They're very manipulative and
well, I'm sorry to get on my soapbox, but
it's a real problem, obviously, and there are loopholes or ways around the laws. There are ways to make it so difficult to prove anything,
right?
That people can get away. Lisa, I was just thinking about something, and I want to touch base with you and get your opinion. There are a few other high-profile trials pending. One that comes to mind is the Anthony case, the Casey Anthony case in Florida. Another one is this Sandra Cantu case, where she was allegedly murdered by the Sunday school teacher in California. And do you have any feeling at this point, a gut feeling, or perhaps some knowledge, you think these are going to be televised cases, or no?
Gosh, I hope so. Florida, and what was the other? Where was the other one? The Anthony
California,
case.
California, I believe, is Cantu.
California is Cantu. Do you know where in California? I don't recall.
That's Modesto.
Is that Modesto?
Yeah.
Modesto or
okay.
Fresno
it might
area.
Be. I don't know that California is not really camera friendly. Phil Spector was the first trial, I think, since OJ that they've allowed gavel to gavel. Everything else that they've allowed in California has been just openings and closings like Blake was. So it's possible. Florida is very camera friendly. Court TV does a lot of cases in Florida, and I would say it's probably, you'll probably see it televised. I should add, though, I don't know if anyone knows this yet, but In Session is going to be folded into CNN. So there's not going to be as much trial coverage as there is now. They're kind of taking it out of the – they're closing the New York office, and they're laying off a lot of people, and basically they're going to keep the correspondents who cover the trials and a few of the producers, and they're going to be handling
it now.
So
no live trials, just like updates?
That's too bad.
No, they're gonna do live trial coverage, but I'm not sure exactly how they're going to compress it. But it's basically gonna go under the CNN banner. So I think that's all kind of being figured out right now. But this is recent news. They're closing the New York office and they're letting go of the anchors, the In Session anchors.
Because, like you had said before, Lisa. If we're going to follow them, we need to see them we need to see them gavel to gavel. And it seems
which
like,
is so sad to me. Yeah,
yeah.
And we're getting less and less of that.
Choose what parts they want to show, and you know they've
mm-hmm.
really kind of gotten off track that way. But they take too many breaks. They take too many commercial breaks.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about what's been happening, I mean, I think this is all a recession-era issue. When Court TV was kind of taken over fully by Time Warner and the Liberty Media part was sold to Warner, we all saw the writing on the wall. We all knew that the guy who was heading this division saw Court TV as not really valuable and he was more interested in entertainment and the reality shows that are at the end of the night.
You know, a lot of us
TV.
On here subscribed to that Live Extra
yeah.
that they had a few
oh.
years ago. Oh, my gosh, that was
they
heaven.
Wasn't it wonderful? And
yeah.
I have to say, it's really up to you guys to kind of keep the reporting going. I have a very good friend in L.A., Betsy Ross, who runs her own blog, and I met her at the Robert Blake criminal trial. And
Rocket.
I think
yeah,
it was
one
of her first trials. Yeah, and she has her own
blog site, and she now will go to these trials full time, and she's really it. If it's not being covered on TV by Court TV, she's the only one in the courtroom who's telling everybody what happens day to day to day, hour to hour. And I got to say, that's kind of what it's moving towards, is for, you know, the crime junkies like us to
a lot of us wouldn't
to be the voices
about Spectre, but she kept us in the loop on the Spectre.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of responsibility with that, of course. You know, I mean, as a reporter, I have to really, really be neutral. I have to be fair. I have to presume innocence. You know, I have to do as much as I can to show both sides of the case. And I got to say, as there's less and less of us doing gavel-to-gavel coverage, it's up to you guys to be that way, because you're going to be laying the record for the future generations. So, you know, keep it in mind.
I was just thinking it probably makes shows like this one and several others, and I know there are several blog talk shows that discuss crime and trials and so forth, maybe even a little more important role if the live coverage is going to be somewhere to keep the debate going and keep the information flowing.
Yeah, much more important and really valuable. And, you know, and I hope that more people will turn to you guys and will turn to Juror 13, and you know, with that sense, it's a responsibility. You know, it really is.
Juror 13 is fantastic too. They really have, keep us up to date on everything too. So
and
now the way Court TV has become, we kind of need multiple media outlets to keep us in the loop, because it doesn't seem like one place is enough anymore. So
yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like on a blog, although Sprocket, that's the best. So she did a fantastic job, but it doesn't seem like TV, that what they're doing on TV at this time anyway is enough to really keep you to the point where at the end of the trial you feel like you can really, that you've seen everything. So yep.
Well, sure. Juror 13, actually, I don't know if you were aware of this, Lisa, but it came about pretty much as a result of the Spectre trial, the first Phil Spectre trial. Several of the people were interested in that trial and communicated in chat rooms and so on and so forth. And Chloe, who founded Juror 13, decided even after the trial and before the second trial to open the Juror 13 site, and people congregated there, and of course drew in new people, and now it's a good source to go to for updates on trials and
very good
and rehashing.
And what we do, and what Chloe's really good at, is searching around all the other sources and finding other live feeds. We've had local live feeds from Boston and from Colorado, but you've got to know where they are. You've got there's not any notice that pops up and tells you when there's going to be a local live feed. So
right.
Chloe's really good about pulling that stuff together.
She's fantastic. So I mean, we have Sprocket for the blog, you know, keeps us up almost minute to minute the way she does it. And then Juror 13 is fantastic. She has the updates, she has the links, she has the live links. It seems like we have multiple things now, where in the beginning we had, way in the beginning, in 2002 or whenever the inception of Court TV was, they were gavel to gavel, and then that was all you needed. I mean, they didn't take breaks. They didn't do anything. You watched the trial all day, and they veered from that dramatically through the years, more so to the point where you just don't feel you're getting enough of it. I don't anyway. Maybe some people do, but I feel like too much can be missed.
Yeah, all really good points. And I didn't know about that. This sprang from the Phil Spector trial, and that's great. That's great news.
Ladies, I don't know where the time went to. We're down to our last minute and a half or so. I wanted to mention something now that Lisa's had the Juror 13 experience, if you will. when we had talked earlier and corresponded, we were talking about some of the various cases she's covered, and she's covered a lot, and various types. There have been the high-profile celebrity cases. There have been the so-called Black Widow cases Kendi, you can relate to that because
yeah.
you're into some of the Black Widow stuff. And I mentioned at that time that if Lisa enjoyed herself and enjoyed talking with us, maybe she'd come back from time to time and we could do specials, maybe a Black Widow special, and discuss some of the Black Widow cases.
That would be great.
Or the celebrity trials. And,
please do.
And of course, tonight we've got the, you know, talking about the Trimble trial. So I'll be after you again, Lisa, to set up some more events with us.
Oh, I'd love that. I love talking with you guys. And whatever you want to talk about, Black Widow or celebrity trials or, you know, just let me know. Let's do it. It would be really fun and my pleasure.
I always enjoy your field updates, too, Lisa. You did a really, you've always do a good job on that.
Thank you.
We've just been cut off. I want to thank everybody. Lisa, thank you so much. Lovey, thank you a million. Kendi, thank you. Doc, thanks for the phone call. And everybody in the chat room who was keeping things going and asking questions, I really appreciate
it. Can I say thank you to Lisa because we do watch you, and I've been watching this trial, and was so delighted to know that you were going to be the guest tonight, and there you were. That was a very cool surprise.
Oh, I wish we still had the Court TV blogs and all that, so we could keep in touch that way.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, you guys. It's been great meeting you both, and Denny, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lisa, and I'll be in touch, and we'll do it again.
Thanks, Denny.
Okay, great.
See you, Lisa. Bye.
Night, everybody.
Yeah, night.
Bye, everybody. Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
No, thank you. Bye.